Hey there, this is Cross. Oh no, fuck. A word to the wise, we are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes, as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. This week, that is through the end of part 3, Sapani, being best served cold. Hey there, this is Cross.
And we are Words and Whiskey.
A podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club.
I'm PJ, by the way, if you couldn't tell.
Skipping things already.
Yep.
Messed it up right away in the beginning, right in the intro. This is one that we're recording on Thursday to go out tomorrow. Yeah. So we'll get there. But I'm very excited to chat about this. It's a shorter episode in theory by length of chapters and the physical amount of stuff to talk about. So,
yeah,
I may have cursed us once again, but oh my God, our page count is twice as light as it usually is. So I hope it's not that bad. But it's our fourth episode talking about Best Trip Cold by Joe Abercrombie. We're reading Cooking Up Trouble Through What Happened. Four chapters, quick and dirty.
Quick overview? We got this.
Quick and dirty.
Yep. 4 hours later, we're still recording. 4 hours from now, you're like on a plane or something, right?
In 9 hours. So by the time that I'm done with this, I will have I have to play games with my family for like an hour, and then I'm going to bed.
Yeah.
And then I wake up. So I'm getting like 3 or 4 hours of sleep.
You got this.
So I got this. What's that overview, though?
Everything goes wrong, but Ario dies.
You know, it's pretty accurate. if you're looking for a quick overview, it's pretty much exactly what happened. So first off, before we get into this, quick little mini cheers to the episode. To that part of life at the moment. We're going to try to, you know, just kind of ride through this and talk about it. How'd you feel about this week's reading, PJ? How'd you feel about this little chunk?
You said quick and dirty. It was quick and dirty. It was a very fun, yeah, blazing fast little section for us. God damn it, did I love Friendly's interaction with everything here.
Yeah.
That was the biggest highlight, I think.
Part of the reason that I segmented this out is because it is quick and dirty, right? Like, I think it's like 43 pages or something like that. So this is like the shortest section outside of the end of novels, I think, that we've covered in a while on the show, at the very least, definitely for Joe Abercrombie. But also so much happens. Like, your quick overview is cute because it is very true. Everything goes wrong, but everything going wrong and in the ways that it does is the fascination here.
Right.
And I really wanted to be able to spend time to like dig into, especially Sex and Death and the follow up and what happened and kind of spend the time to kind of really look closely at these characters and especially imagine the way that this would be depicted on screen, because this is incredible for adaptation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Any other high level thoughts?
Our boy is back in town.
Our boy was back.
And he's smoking opium and banging hookers, apparently.
Fucking Giselle, man. I've been waiting for this, like, since we started the book. I was like, this happens at some point. I don't remember exactly when it happens. Obviously, when I broke it down, I did get there. But I was like, oh, shit, this is so much earlier than I thought it was. So, yeah, I am so excited. So I want to just give us the quote at the very top of part 3 here one more time, just for a refresher for everyone, because I think that this is it kind of fits in an interesting way as we begin to contemplate a lot of this. But once again, the quote: the belief in a supernatural source of evil is not necessary. Men alone are quite capable of every wickedness. From Joseph Conrad, once again. But
yep, still applicable. Still works here.
It's as though it was chosen for maybe the end of the section and not maybe the beginning.
Worked in the beginning too, though.
Yeah, true. Okay, cool. So we'll kick it off with Cooking Up Trouble. We return to Koska, and he's having a really rough time with his role, working for Mikado at the moment and dealing with his sort of forced sojourn into sobriety. He talks at Friendly, recounting his loss to Mercado and generally bemoaning his station and lot in life, having supported Monza and her career as Friendly makes porridge.
Talks at Friendly, I think, is the right way to phrase what he's doing. There's just so much humor in the way that Friendly is just acting as a sounding board here. Little one word or two word quips here and there, and that's about it. But generally, seeing Casca go through his internal monologue as he wakes up and like gets ready for the day and actively slips into this sort of self-soothing, talking about whatever to distract himself from the call of the bottle was really an interesting experience, I think.
Yeah, it really is, because it does color Casca more deeply. And as we've seen Casca, he's almost exclusively been drunk over the course of every moment that we've seen him. Mm. And this is like sobered up Casca. Like, he was sober when we were previously talking to him, not where we actually like started at the very beginning of this, but now he's like clean, as it were,
right?
And that makes for a very different monologue and sort of thought process, and there's clarity to a character that has otherwise been confused. Yeah, it's a cool moment. We get more of those, of course, over the course of this, so that's also great. From there, we move to his arch rival, or perhaps they're just each other's arch rival in the immediate moment, Morvir, waking up early as well and treating himself with his own variety of poisons to inure himself from their effects, accompanied by some cold oatmeal. As he downs the content of each of these different poisons, it kind of seems to me like his body is fighting him and he can't stomach them anymore. You know, obviously he's puking them up over the balcony, but this is sort of, I think, what Day was talking about when she was saying he's getting old in a lot of ways. But beyond that, he reflects more on his lot of the people who failed to appreciate him, as like he reflects on the orphanage and like, you know, his old wife and a number of other people that are just kind of brought up as Day knocks on the door.
Of all the poisons that he's consuming here, the worst has to be the cold oatmeal, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
Who the fuck does that? We know he has access to heating implements because he has hot tea.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So he's actively
cold oatmeal.
Choosing to eat cold oatmeal.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that has to be to attempt to like settle his stomach, where he's found it to be effective on top of it, maybe? I don't know. That's the only way that I can maybe imagine stomaching cold oatmeal.
Fucking gross, man.
Fucking gross.
But
yeah,
that's
true.
I think it might be.
Yeah, I think so.
I think so.
Yeah.
Didn't peg him as a married man.
Well, he's not.
Well, he's not anymore. His thoughts and interactions with Day have not gotten any less weird either.
Yeah.
I don't think they've gotten necessarily more weird, but they have not tamed at all.
They're pretty much maintaining.
Strange.
Yeah. Pretty much maintaining exactly where they were before, as though like nothing's changed, but something should have changed.
Mm.
Yeah. It's a weird one. Yeah. Morvir's an interesting guy. And the deeper we get into this, the more the Joe Abercrombie joke just becomes funnier and funnier as he sees himself as Morvir.
Yeah.
So.
I am curious about the sickness, though. If it's truly just him no longer being able to stomach the poisons, or if there is.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've got a scrutinous eye on Day right now.
Fair. Interesting. I did want to also bring up here, this isn't necessarily maybe the place where it makes the most sense, but we were talking about like kind of questioning whether or not the wife was brought up before. It has been brought to my attention multiple times through multiple channels of communication that we have been repeating incorrect things about Vitari. Vitari is described as having short, spiky hair. I did go back and confirm.
Seriously?
Sure. Yep. Yeah. Red, short, spiky hair.
I swear there was something about curls.
Hair.
Who described curly hair?
Someone else. Yeah. Artie definitely has like brown curlier hair, not like curly, but
interesting. Okay.
Glocked his pubes?
Probably glocked his pubes.
Probably.
That's what I'm thinking.
You think
of.
He has any? I don't know. I feel like it's just scorched earth down there. Seems to make the most sense to me.
Oh, so Jesus.
From there, we then turn to Friendly as our party assembles for the real shindig at Cardati's, as these 25 ready themselves, as these various like scoundrels that we had been interviewing previously ready themselves. And Koska offers our boy Friendly the job of minding the dice table, which he is so excited for.
Fuck yes.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. And he gets a snake eye mask.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. I mean, I was trying to picture what that could look like. You'd have to have it like, it couldn't just be two squares with two dots in the middle. It wouldn't look like dice. It'd have to be like parametric view of the dice, but offset so the one pips are like in the, I don't know. I want to see what it would look like.
Yeah. Did you look at the image, the thing that I had sent you on Instagram from Beer is the Mind Killer?
No.
Oh, man. Okay, so he's been reading through this and a little bit in front of us in general, and so he's been doing some illustrations here and there. And I think he sent it like a week or two ago or put it out there, but I sent it to you now that you've read the section earlier today. So
gotcha.
You could check it out.
Yeah, busy day. Didn't do a whole lot of social media checking today.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. You have had a weird day. It's been a weird week, to say the least, on so many more fronts than one. But yeah, yeah.
I don't think I have to be coy about it. I got laid off today, so.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, very unfortunate.
Of course. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
This is my only job now.
So, yeah, as far as I viewed the Snake Eyes mask, I do like, again, Beer is the Mind Killer did a great job, I think, rendering it.
I can look at it right now.
I imagine it.
Let's see.
Yeah, you could totally pull it out and look at it. I kind of imagine it as just like with a small alteration. Obviously, like the snake eyes are where like the eyes poke out and what you see. But I do think, or where like the eyes themselves would be. But I do also think that I would, on a mask in an Italian style, I would imagine a little bit of a snake flourish on the sides, like almost like a snake eating the dice. Yeah.
This is so fucking good.
Yeah, the other half of that is apologize to my fucking dice as he pulls out the cleaver and his knife.
And it's a five and a six. Good. Of course.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's so good.
Yeah, it's very good. It's so good. The art is excellent. And also, it's rendered with, God, one of the songs that's used all the time in Kill Bill, that, like, siren. And it's very clearly, you know, ripped from the, that thing. So good. Well done. Good choice. Definitely check that out. Reshared it on our story again today because it's extra relevant. But
cool.
Yeah. But that's how I imagine the mask at the very least. So turning from there to the streets themselves, finally, we see the whole city kind of begin this midday party of sorts in a way that feels to me reminiscent of Mardi Gras in some way. Like there's a lot of like marching and kind of like people going through the streets, and Shivers has this sort of like worry and fear about anyone and everyone of whom could be behind masks and could be a terrifying, you know, bump in the night, but then kind of comes to terms with the fact that, well, they're probably the scary ones.
Yeah, that's a good realization to come to. There's gotta be some shady motherfuckers in masks lurking around, though. Like, it's not unfounded. Yeah. This is Sapani, Crossland.
This is Sapani, yeah. And I of course forgot to mention that they make it to the gate and then they're basically admitted right away, which is kind of crazy.
He doesn't even introduce him. Like, maybe just knowing that Carlet Danida was putting on the thing was enough for them to be like, and they're probably actually the entertainment. Because they are.
Right.
And maybe they were.
And this is Sapani.
And this is Sapani. But it's not like they're lying to get in. They were legitimately the entertainment for the night. So,
right. They were legitimately hired. Whether or not they're skilled or talented at their jobs is another question entirely, like, that gets brought up multiple times.
That's irrelevant, Crossland.
Yeah.
They're skilled at something.
Yeah.
Entertainment?
Very true.
Maybe not it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love, there's a little conversation that happens between Shivers and Casca that I love, as they're talking about, again, honor has been like a thing that's been recurring from Shivers' perspective as he's trying to reflect on being a better man and whatnot. And I believe it's Casca that says, shit at least makes flowers grow. Honor isn't even that useful. And oof, oof.
I mean, this topic comes up in most of the books that we read, the value mm-hmm. of honor. And I love how varied that opinion can be. And mm-hmm. like, everybody makes valid points to that opinion, whatever opinion they hold, but it really does come up often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think honor is such a concept that is so related to like fighting forces and people that are in conflict with one another. And we're mostly, I mean, say what you will about most of the series that we're reading, but they're mostly martial in a lot of ways. Like, we're mm-hmm. dealing with characters that are at war or going to war in some capacity or fighting a lot more directly. So yeah, honor, of course, is a central theme.
Right.
But some of our series focus on like the difference between honor and valor, you know, versus this is like, well, why would you have valor if you barely have honor? Like, it doesn't even enter the conversation.
Right.
But also, like, shit being more useful than honor is just a prime, perfect, you know.
It is a very good Marvier quote, too.
Mm-hmm.
It was Marvier.
Is it Marvier?
Right? Hey, who was
it? For some reason, actually, I thought it was Casca. I had it in my head.
Ah, it could be Casca.
I thought that it was, hang on, I'm going to look this up because I like it too much. Casca. It is Casca.
Hmm. Makes sense for him, too.
They're talking, yeah. They're talking about, like, everyone to some degree is a whore, right? It's just, like, who and what you're doing that for.
Right.
And that's where, like, you know, at least there's not much honor in that. You know, shit at least makes the flowers grow. Honor isn't even useful. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And to that point, there's a lot of conversations about the whorehouse and Cardates and how about soldiery being a part of the workforce, that it's all kind of the same thing, you know, culminates in the quote. No. And also there's this other side of that where, like, no one really wants you when you're old and whatnot. So I just curious on like what you made of Casca's whole commentary there.
I think the best part of it is how well it mirrors Shivers' own estimation of mm-hmm. the situation that he's gotten himself into and what he is and all of that. But regardless of that connection, Casca does make a good point. It's not necessarily a unique one, but the idea of whatever you do to make some money, you're selling yourself at least a little bit. If mm-hmm. it's your time or your energy or your physicality or whatever it might be. But
mm-hmm.
to draw a specific line is arbitrary and dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. Arbitrary and dumb for sure. It's interesting to add like age as a problem.
Yeah, that's true.
There, because like age is also kind of an arbitrary line, like if you're capable enough or otherwise. Although you do, generally speaking, like just in general, decline with age as well. So there comes a point when that line is pretty firmly drawn. So,
yeah.
On your utility. But Sartorius hasn't passed that line yet somehow. Old Sartorius.
Old Sartorius.
Yeah. We didn't talk about him a whole lot last week, but obviously, like, you know, it's interesting to reflect on when he's talking about age. Yeah, he comes up a couple of times from Casca and whatnot. So we end... Sorry, we then turn to Monza meeting Ida at the party, and what a confrontation that this is, as she is also shocked to meet Casca. Ida is in desperate need of her cure, as she feels she has done well to coordinate all this, despite the pressure and potential for failure, and Monza couldn't be more opposed to Ida's sentiment of living in fear of anyone else. You know, it's very interesting as far as this goes. Kind of badass, as she's like, Aria or bust, you know? She's yeah. like, I'm not dealing with that.
Are we to assume that her reaction here and her kind of outburst towards Ida here is what drove Ida to write that letter eventually to Orso? Or are we... Does she say when she wrote the letter? This is kind of where I assumed she did.
I think she wrote it before. And the reason why is coming up to some degree with Yoru.
But yeah. That makes sense.
Because he's going to Orso, right?
Right.
So I assume that he's got to be
he's the delivery boy.
If he's not the delivery man, but he might be.
Right.
I don't know. Because that would also, Yoru would also be a tool potentially for Glockta, right?
Yeah.
Like they work for the same guy.
They do.
At the very least, the coworkers.
Right. Regardless, even if she hadn't, like, it would have been prudent for Monza to kind of keep her head a little bit here, because,
yeah,
like, as we see in the end, like, there are still ways that she gets fucked, potentially.
Yeah.
There are still wrenches to be thrown into the machine.
Mm-hmm. Right. And wrenches, how they fly.
They...
notoriously
unpredictable.
Yeah. Wrenches. How do they work? Isn't it like gravity? How does it work? Or
magnets.
Something like that? Magnets. How do they work? Yeah. Oh, man. What a kid. That's Anchorman, right?
That's just Juggalos. That's the Insane Clown Posse.
Is it?
Yeah.
What? I genuinely... I thought that it was an Anchorman quote, I swear. You gotta be kidding me. Oh god, it is. Oh my god. How did I not know that? I just assumed that came out of Ron Burgundy's mouth at some point during one of those movies.
Totally plausible that could have
it
happened.
Fits
it does
absolutely
fit.
With Ron Burgundy. No, yeah.
Nope. It's ICP.
Wow. Holy shit. Okay, so moving on from Ida being, you know, pissed off, and she definitely should have kept her cool. Everything could have gone way worse than it already did. She also maybe could have gotten more information about who's attending instead of Foscar from her in that moment, you know, like,
yeah, that could have happened.
Yeah. In addition, her shock with Koska, I think, is such a cool moment, too, where it's like there's this reflection of like, I thought you died. And it's like, everyone, I did, too. But the bottle convinced me otherwise. I was just drunk. It's a little different. But
did they have much in the way of like direct interactions on page before they were hanged?
I think that he arrested her. And that's like the big thing that happened. Like he was in charge and responsible for like bagging her at some point, but that's about it.
Okay.
Like not a ton.
Gotcha.
But aware of, though, for sure, because Glockta kind of lorded it over a couple of times or made mention of once or twice.
Right.
So yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So we end this first chapter here, turning to Morvir and seeing his and Day's preparations in the royal suite, setting up a hole to see into the room where Vitari and Mikado have set up as entertainment, we'll say.
Mm-hmm. There's so much whimsy to the way that Morvir and Day's conduct is written.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is. I don't know why, but there's just so much fun intertwined into all of it. I really enjoy it.
It whimsy is a great way to describe it. It just feels like they're kind of like professional tomfoolery people.
You know,
like they're like jokes as people themselves, but like also professional, and also like there's this sort of familiarity between them that's really interesting, as like there's a clear bond that exists, but it's like not bi-directional in the same way between them. And yeah, it's interesting.
There's also just the voice that Joe uses while writing these sections are so full of detail. Mm-hmm. Like the hand crank drill that Day is using, and the illumination of like a circle of light on her cheek as she like smiles up. Like it's just a different style of detail compared to the other perspectives that he writes within, which I find really interesting.
He has such a good mastery of character voice in a way that like no one else that we've read has as good of a mastery of character voice, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think I would go so far as to say that I think of the people that we've talked about reading on the show, I think that the best character writer that we will read on the show is Joe Abercrombie. This is like his specialty.
Yeah, I didn't have the right words to describe what I was talking about, I think, with when we interviewed Mike. Because I tried asking about this. I tried talking about this, but we kind of swerved into talking about inner monologues. But character voice, I think, was the word I was looking for specifically.
Yeah. He's just so good at like getting us into different people's mentalities, right? And the way that they think and kind of work. And that's like especially apparent when you like cut between someone like Koska and someone like Friendly, and then more Veer, and then Monza, and then Shivers. Like, even the way that they each approach the same situations. And this week in particular is one in which no single chapter is locked into one person's perspective.
True.
We are POV hopping the whole way through.
And sometimes at a blistering speed.
Yeah. Yeah. Like two paragraphs in Friendly's chat in Friendly's voice. Okay, now three paragraphs in Shivers. Okay, one paragraph in Costco watching Shivers and also doing something else. Okay, up to more Viren Day. What are they doing? Oh, they're hanging out. They got their two guards. Okay, sweet. Monza for like a page. Okay.
I mean, it's perfect for the Ocean's 11 style, a bunch of panels on screen showing what everybody's doing at once.
Yeah. Yeah. This is Soderbergian for sure. Steven Soderbergh. And it is so good. So let's talk about it. Let's get into sex and death, because we're already like jumping ahead to talk about how fucking cool this is. And it's also in the next chapter after this, of course. That's entertainment. But sex and death is one of the longest chapters that we've read. Definitely in this book, at the very least, if not on the show. But it's a long one.
Mm-hmm.
So we open the chapter with Friendly trying to keep himself calm and measured by rolling the dice as best he can. All the while, Koska manages the party on the side, of which is overflowing with way more guests than were anticipated or expected. We also get a good look at Koska's internal measure of himself, clear of alcohol for the first time in a while, like I had mentioned earlier. There's this great quote that he has internally, again, his internal monologue, where he says he's talking about what he fears, and he's reflecting on something that Shivers had said at some point as he prepares here in the moment. He says he feared old age, failure, betrayal, and looking a fool. Yet he never feared before a fight. Koska's happiest moments had been spent waiting for battles to begin, watching the countless Gurkish march upon the walls of Dagoska, watching the forces of Sapani deploy before the Battle of the Isles, scrambling onto his horse by moonlight when the enemy sallied from the walls of Muris. Danger was the thing he most enjoyed. Worries for the future, purged. Failures of the past, erased. Only the glorious now remained. He closed his eyes and sucked in air, felt it tingling pleasantly in his chest, heard the excited babbling of the guests. He scarcely even felt the need for a drink anymore.
I can't remember if a similar sentiment of like not having fear before a battle was expressed by Logan or by Darrow in the Red Rising series, or by both of them. It might have been both of them. But the idea of that calm before the storm, and all of that is born out of confidence, I think. But the difference being Logan and Darrow's source of that confidence is preparedness and talent. And Koska's, well, like he's prepared and he's talented, but primarily he's confident because he's socially sort of positioned himself to always be on the stronger side. So his confidence lies in the prowess of the side that he happens to have chosen. Like, still, battles are battles and odds can be beaten. But so in that respect, there is overlap and kinship in those expressed feelings, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I'm not exactly sure which character it was. I'm leaning towards Darrow.
I think so, too. I'm thinking like Dark Age.
Yeah, Logan has a moment in specifically The Last Argument of Kings, but often I think he's like overcome with other anxieties, but they aren't like holding him from making a decision, you know, in general. But I do think that it's Darrow on the whole. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. This is sort of a monstrous thing. And I like your comparison of what they're pulling on. Like his sort of he's a social gamer more than he is a physical force to be reckoned with. Although there's something to be said that he is also a strategic talent, which is a little bit different. But to kind of take a third lens on this, he's also an addict. He's addicted to this.
That's
he's addicted to the adrenaline. And I think that is also like a moment of clarity, right? It's a little bit different than sort of the fear angle, but it's clear that Koska has an addictive personality, and this is one of the many things that sates those urges. Mm-hmm. So if he doesn't have a battle, he goes to the bottle, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah. Even sometimes, yeah. Even sometimes in battle. So we cut from there to Koska's conversation with Aryo and Foskar, seeing them as well as Yoru Sulfur making mention of Talons and needing to go make his way to Orso regarding the Gurkish. He directs the pair of brothers up to the suite, of course, as the musicians failed to play well in the background.
Yoru.
And I say Foskar in quotes.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yoru's making deals and wheeling about, but to your point, I hadn't made that connection that this is probably the message that he's bringing is probably the letter that Ida wrote, which makes so much more sense. I'm curious about Jizal here. I mean, granted, this has been years. He talks later, makes allusions to having several children already and another on the way. So it's been years since the end of last argument, but
yeah,
I want to know his relationship with Yoru. If he ever was able to understand who he was, or what his relationship with him is, because this is a man very clearly with the same eye colors as Morovia, in also in quotes.
So
I don't know.
I don't want to cut you off too much here, but he did see Morovia's skin slough off Yoru's face. When he used the divine.
You're right.
So like,
okay. Yeah.
The mask fell off and he went, and that's when I think Jizal started puking. Yeah. So he definitely knows Yoru and like definitely would get a vibe, from the sort of demands and that like Baez is watching.
Yep. You're right.
Yeah.
I had forgotten about that part.
But a good thought though. Like, again, this is one of those interesting things that this is a conversation that we can only have because we've read, you know, the first trilogy. Mm-hmm. And so this is standalone, but this is an interesting bit of like background politics that, you know, we get to kind of latch into for even a paragraph or two.
Which is not lost on the people that haven't read it, is entirely invisible to the people that haven't read it.
Yeah. They're like, who's this? What's that? Oh, Aryo and Foskar. Okay, that's what we care about here.
Right.
And this Yoru guy who's bippity bopping around the fucking
right.
Who is this guy? He talks to the banker. He talked to. Yeah. Yeah.
Bippity boppity.
Really interesting. I do love that Koska like doesn't recognize as well that this isn't Foskar, and he would have no reason to assume that it's not.
He makes a point of the beard.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, being well trimmed.
Or that he's grown a beard.
I think you're right because then no so it's not him that's made the point about the beard, it is Manza.
Okay.
Manza makes the point about the beard.
Well, she does too, but she recognizes right away that it's not Foskar.
Yeah,
but
because Koska so
definitely makes mention of like, oh, he looks a little different, oh whatever, it's fine.
Yeah.
But
you're right. And that's probably you're totally correct, and that's because he hasn't seen him in a long time, like he's long disconnected from them, and then Manza confirms that this is someone else fully. Because she's like, his beard is not that well maintained by comparison, because I think Benna even in the very first chapter compliments the beard, doesn't he compliments
I
the facial
remember.
Hair I'm pretty sure he does.
That's plausible. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure that's how that first chapter opens when they're like talking. Anyway. I digress. We see the brothers then kind of going upstairs, split in the hallway in Morvir's perspective before we stumble into Manza's, evaluating the room and the odd bed and wallpaper choices. They conflict with each other with these like teal sheets and the crazy aquamarine walls or whatever. and questioning the sort of titillating painting and why every painting just needs a boob out or two. And she and Vitari prepare themselves for their guests as they expect them both to enter this room in the moment. Vitari has a wonderful line here that she says, unless you decided you'd rather fuck them instead of killing them, when they're surprised by none other than the king of the union himself as that well-cropped beard walks into view and everything else.
The best part of this reveal. I mean, we already knew who it was. But the best part for me was Pacey slipping back into Giselle's voice.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a comfort.
It's like a huge complication is what it is to the plan.
Yeah.
But it's still really nice to see our boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is really nice to have our boy back in the story, if even for a flicker of a moment, you know, effectively right here in front of us. Mm-hmm. But what a fun complication to have him right there.
Right.
And the voice return. Mm. Yeah. And then what a fucking sick smash cut to Koska uttering a similar refrain saying, unless you decided you'd rather fuck them instead.
Yeah, that was a good transition, too.
Yeah. And this calls attention to the duel in the circle and the reenactment therein. And I'm going to compress a little bit of this one kind of into one here because it does kind of hop back and forth, but it's so short, like we were kind of saying earlier. So they're getting ready to call the circle fight, of course. And when they do call the fight after one of the other cuts that we have here, Greylock comes at him much harder than expected. And we come to understand that this fight is so much more personal for Greylock as he lost a brother in the taking of Uthrith, one of those men that Dogman killed on the docks. And he's going to take Shiver's head as compensation.
Yeah. One of the four guys that died in that entire taking of the city. Right. Man.
That they're so proud of.
Yeah. So proud of how bloodless it was.
Yeah.
Right.
And we got the one fucking guy.
The one fucking guy. I don't think I made this a bet, but I was not at all surprised by this occurrence.
No. I'll drink for it. I feel like it's worthy because you did bring it up. You're like, man, I don't feel like this is going to go right. So cheers.
Cheers.
But yeah, it's a crazy moment and it only gets crazier. Like, he starts coming at him and the crowd is genuinely impressed. Like everything else, for the most part, from the entertainment perspective, seems to be lackluster outside of friendly in the table. But that makes people angry. But this, they're like, whoa. It's spectacle.
they were a tough crowd to like convince to start watching it too, though.
Yeah. In the moment, they're like, "What's this gonna be?
What the fuck? He's got 10 fingers."
Yeah. The battle between Fenris the Feared and Logan Nine Fingers. He's got fucking 10. Oh man!
And Fenris is just painted blue. There's no intricate like script, but
tattoos.
Of course,
there's nothing. Yeah, doesn't need to be more than that. But also, the other side of this, too, is sort of the brutal choice to represent or to have Shivers represent Logan is, like, deeply ironic.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Like,
wildly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't consider that at all in the moment. But it is wildly ironic because he's seeing the means to an end. So, meanwhile, we have another short beat checking in on Friendly at the table with his drunk patrons, and they're all mad as they lose a bunch of money. And he's like, it's just the dice, dudes. We'll take a moment also to talk about how this ends here, you know, as this kind of progresses in a similar sort of way. We'll cut it all together here. Crescent Moon keeps losing his money and losing control, as he's described at the table. He calms himself, but keeps pressing, and he's kind of like managing the table himself. Like Crescent Moon is trying to like, he's drunk, but he's managing as best as he can. And he calls the dice a liar's. And he says, did you call my dice a fucking liar? And he's got this butcher cleaver on the side. He's got this other knife. He stabs that guy through the eye and he's thinking poke, 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 which is such a funny thing. Like, he's thinking poke him with the stick, poke him with the knife, but then shouts, apologize to my fucking dice. And yeah, you know,
it's such a fucking brutal scene.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Just the cleaver coming through the skull and out the back.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and it's so fucking lucky for Friendly that all hell breaks loose. And
yeah,
this just kind of gets lost in the chaos, seemingly. I mean, we'll see. But it seems like he kind of got off scot-free for this, because everything else goes to shit completely, like, or just around it.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, man.
Completely goes to shit.
I do feel for him, though. Like, I also have an emotional and intimate relationship with my dice, and it really deeply hurts me whenever you or our other friends or even my wife call my dice cursed. Of course, I would never escalate to brutal murder for the infraction.
You're calling it an infraction when your dice roll bad?
No, when you insult them for rolling bad.
Yeah, right. Your dice roll bad and I'm insulting them because they're bad.
We've been playing a lot of Yahtzee.
So we'll look past my infraction.
And my wife won't play with my dice anymore because she called them cursed and brought all the bad memories of rolling poorly in D&D back to me.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Were they the metal dice?
One of them was. I mean,
okay.
All of my T6s.
Yeah.
We've gone through all of them, Crossland.
All of your dice are cursed. See, personally, I just always felt like it was your metal dice that were cursed. Every time you rolled your metal D20, I swear to God, you couldn't roll higher than a 10. every single time. And out of your dice tower, worst of all.
Like, oh, yeah, it was fucking terrible. Did not
roll any of the sides. Very funny. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Funny. So, yeah, what a moment, what a scene. You're definitely right. I, again, really, really love The Beer is the Mind Killer. Little art for that is so fucking good.
It's so good.
As those numbers. Yeah, it's so good. It's so perfect. Go check it out. I'll probably reshare it after this episode comes out. But yeah, from there, then we turn to Monza and her encounter with the King Jizal. He mentions his wife consenting to this and them having their third child on the way. He has an immediate preference for dark hair, and he thinks that the two of them would be too much. Makes sense if you consider Artie as well. This is sort of a, oh my God, you're seeking a fantasy that you miss, and that's so sad. You're just a sad, sad man, aren't you? And in that moment, Jizal, you know, after Vitari leaves, Jizal is his usual kind of awkward self. In the moment, it's a fun sort of return to the character for us. And to get herself out of this sort of situation in which she might have to fuck the king, she even considers it for a moment. She's like, what is it? Like Stalicus wrote that there were two paths, you know, and take the higher.
If there are two paths, take the better or whatever.
Yeah.
And if there were the Raven something.
Yeah.
Wrote, if there are two paths, find a third.
Find a third through. And it's such a good moment. I just love like going from the one and being like, again, she's just kind of taking the advice that she needs in the moment and blending it to like serve her purpose as opposed to interpreting it the way that she should, you know, like. It's like people that just read self-help and read like a wide variety and can like quote any one instance of it back to you where it's like, okay, but like that conflicts with this other ideal that you're holding in your head. So you don't actually have any ideals is what you're suggesting. And I think that this is the first time that like that kind of becomes more apparent for Monza is that, you know, she's willing to break any of the rules to get this done now.
Right.
And is very flexible.
Including the social rule of not outing somebody to somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very true. So she lights her husk pipe, giving it to Jal and also taking a huff herself in the middle of the rest of this, which was a fucking crazy idea. Fucking at it.
Stupid like, mistake.
Monza. God damn it.
Stupid. Yep. God damn it.
So stupid. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very, very silly move all around. The sort of haze with which she moves through the rest of this is oof. After making this decision.
Yeah. It's well written.
Yeah. It's very good. It's just pretty sad.
and a totally avoidable self-inflicted problem.
It could have been totally avoided. And we like go from her putting it down and then Giselle even just mentioning the idea of her having some too. And she, without flinching, picks it up, lights it, and like doesn't. It's so minimally and skimpily described that it's like it's a flash. It's an instinct. She goes for it. Like, it's not even a question.
Yeah.
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 Whew. So we then move from our huskhead to Morvir, needing to take care of the guards of the royal suite with our two poisoners ready with their buns and blow darts and their own escape plan. they knock out the two people. Day's eating a bun because Day's always eating something.
Of course.
Yeah. And yeah, the guards get bit by flies.
Yeah. So this, I think, does a pretty good job of making Day shine quite a bit. I think, and giving some credence to her claim that she's just as, if not more, capable than her superior, with Morvir kind of struggling a little bit to take out both of them. And by the time he looks up, Day's guards are well incapacitated. Yeah, cool to see her shine a little bit. Yeah.
She knocks him out. She kicks ass. She does great in this moment. It's a reminder that we love her to some degree. Maybe not love. She's cool.
She's cool. I eat buns all the time, too.
I love buns.
Give me that bun.
Give me that bun. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good moment. So we return from there to Monza, of whom is stumbling down this hallway, seeing purple haze. She has to take off her shoes so that she can walk straight, take off like the high heels that she, or boots or whatever she was wearing. In the moment, she's in this sort of skimpy thing with just some daggers tucked into like the back of her clothing. She's struggling, grabbing doorknobs and railings to try to make it to the door. It's a whole thing.
Yeah, I think it's the ribs of the corset,
yeah.
That the knives are like replaced. She's got thin knives instead of the ribs. That's,
yeah,
gotta be so fucking uncomfortable.
Yeah, there's no way that's a good thing.
But she can't fucking feel it right now anyway.
Right, she can't feel fucking anything right now. Which also, like, man, what a choice. So she then makes it in. There's this interesting flirtatious, quote flirtatious, I'm not saying it's actually, but there's the sort of, you know, I mean, Ario is in a whorehouse. We see the two had walked out previously. She's walking up and he's like asking, she asks like another round or something like that. And he's dick out, you know, just in the moment. She kind of gets over with her mask on, gets on top of him and then takes off her mask. He recognizes who she is and stabs the shit out of him.
Well, before that, there's some freaky amputee play going on.
Oh, yeah, when he's, like, looking at her crushed hand, right?
Well, yeah, because she, like, takes off her gloves.
Corset. Yeah, the gloves, the hand. Yeah.
And she's got the... Is it an amputated hand, or is it, like, a...
No, it's not amputated. It's just, like, disfigured.
She's got some sort of, like, mechanism, though, doesn't she?
I don't think so. I think it's just it's, like, crumpled. It's, like, okay. You know... I'm holding my hand so that PJ can see it, but it's like two fingers are like locked down. So she like can't fight with that hand conventionally.
Gotcha.
But still a hand. So definitely disabled, crippled to kind of the point of what you're saying.
Yeah. For some reason, I thought there was some sort of like prosthetic, but.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that the only like prosthesis-y thing that we're aware of are the coins in her skull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
bone thief. What a dude. What a guy.
He'll come back up, right?
Who knows? I don't know. I do love, though, this description in the murder moment here, in which she stabs him and his breath is leaking out of his body like a fart and this blood is oozing out of him thick and black. And she, I think, also describes like sobering up a little bit in the moment as well. Mm-hmm. Like she gets a sense of clarity, but obviously not like fully cognizant or with it.
Right. Yeah. The whole interaction through that haze of husk was so fun to read. I mean, yeah. Obviously, like, removing the sort of sad aspect of, like, her having to, like, her being so compelled to do this to herself in such a critical moment. Mm-hmm. But it was just such a different perspective to read, and it was really, really fun in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's a very fun moment, and now we're down to 3 and 4.
3 and 4. 3 and 4.
3 and 4.
7.
So from there, we then end our chapter, returning to Shivers, cutting off the arm of Greylock as he charges at him again. And the crowd is very shocked as to how they're pulling this off, because they're like, what? How'd they lop the arm off? Is like real blood kind of spatters. And they imagine, you know, it might be a pig's bladder filled with the fake blood, kind of like they had planned. Before they come to realize that this is very real, as he sort of gasps a dying breath, as Shivers fucking headbutts or pommels the helmet in that he was wearing, a spattering brain matter on the inside of it. Yeah.
So fucking brutal.
And then, if that wasn't bad enough, this crazy moment happens and all the people around are freaking out. Friendly's going off on the inside of the building, but we'll get to that in the next chapter even. There, Arya's naked body comes tumbling down from a window, splashing more blood and gore onto the onlookers as Monza clearly hucked it out.
This scene is going to look so fucking cool on screen.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I'm so excited for it.
Yeah, this is a wild moment. This is not one that you cut, you know. I said before that I think that one of the ways that you would get away with this is you could maybe either shorten or remove one or two of these in the long run. There's no way you cut this one. I think picking which favorite child you're going to cut even is going to be very difficult, but I don't think you cut this one.
I think this one's fine. This one's safe.
Yeah. This one's good. Body out the window, man. It does mean, and this is one of those weird things, and now I can kind of talk to you about it, because I've kind of been holding back on this on the whole, is there are a number of characters that we've seen that would come up in a movie or a TV show adaptation, right? Like Jizal. So you have to cast Jizal for this role, you know?
Yeah.
And Yoru. So... I mean, and Vitari. And Koska.
You have to.
And Shivers.
But do you actually have to? I mean, some of them, yes, you really do. And you should. But there are examples right. of characters. Like, characters can be recast. And
yeah.
stay in universe.
Yeah, but you want them. You want you these want to be the to right be,
You want them to be cast from the beginning.
Yeah. And the other... The other thing is the other thing that is popping up, you know, here and there, too, is like you also don't want to spoil the end of that trilogy, right? Like you don't want to also have the same guy that is Jizal maybe be the Jizal that we're introduced to, because that's going to be real weird. But
that's
like Shivers, probably not bad. Yoru, probably not bad. But specifically Jizal, that might be one that you almost have to rewrite that scene for adaptation. But I don't know. You could rewrite it with Guslav, which could be interesting from one perspective, or one of Guslav's sons instead, to make them out to be more of a piece of shit. But that also then again depends on where you're placing this in the timeline. I think this has to be after the trilogy still to maintain coherency.
Or it could be a dignitary from a different country.
Yeah. You could just swap out the union. The union of it all.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting, especially an adaptation choice to be considered. But I don't know. I kind of like the idea of casting him and, like, you know, you cast whoever it is. We'll just say Austin Butler or whoever we were saying before for Jizal. And you cast him and you have him show up here with like a broken face. And he's only like seen one or two times. And like maybe you don't show his face a whole lot. So then it's more mysterious in the camera angle. And that could work too.
Yeah.
There are ways to play around with this.
You could do it.
If you're looking at the whole scene from like more Veer and Day's perspective too, that could be wild, like through the pinhole, you know?
Yeah. At that point, you could play with camera angles and not actually cast him as anybody.
Yeah, right. right, you could get away with something like that. Yeah. Anyway, interesting thoughts, you know, on adaptation, what that looks like. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone that shows up in one of these books, you just have to remember, you know, like you kind of have to move backwards in time if we're doing this first.
Right.
Which is a weird thought. And yeah. I don't think they changed the timeline order for the record. I think that this still comes in post of that. I wouldn't try to adjust that.
If they change the timeline order, like Shivers doesn't make sense.
Yeah, Shivers' journey doesn't make a whole lot of sense to some degree. But, yeah. And like talking about the myths of the Bloody Nine and things like that could still work. Like it wouldn't ruin anything.
Right.
Just like it doesn't as a standalone. So, yeah. So, yeah, body flies out. There's this great quote that kind of, it doesn't quite close it out fully, but it almost closes out where Shivers mutters, "Why do things like this always happen to me?" And Koska replies, "Because you're a bad, bad man."
Aw. For sure. Aww. Getting painted like that?
I mean, I'm not certain if he's not, like, if it's not tinged in irony.
I think
like
a little bit of irony. I think he's just kind of ribbing him.
Giving him shit.
Yeah.
Ribbing him. Yeah. But then there's the other side of like, well... Well, you did just cut that man in half.
yeah.
All right, cool. So with that, that rounds out, again, a very long chapter, but now we're going to go into our drink segment here. PJ, what are you having on this fine evening?
I, on the fly, made a cocktail called, you and I workshopped it together a little bit on the phone right before we started recording, called Loaded Dice.
Huh?
And it is, the theme of it, to your suggestion, was black and white.
Black and white ingredients. Yeah.
Black and white ingredients for the most part. I mean, primarily it is Fernet Branca, which is very dark, but it is brown. So this whole cocktail ended up being kind of a light brown. It was actually really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But 2 ounces of Fernet Branca, 1 ounce of Orgeot.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up adding 1 ounce of lemon juice, all shaken with ice, and then I removed the ice and shook it again with an egg white and topped it with 6 drops of Mole bitters to make the loaded dice right on top. Mm-hmm. So I've got to play with the ratios a little bit, but I actually really, really like this.
One,
yeah,
from a photogenic standpoint, needs to go on the website. That'll
go up there.
Because like the dice that you drew with the dots, I hadn't even considered, and what a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to, I think it would have worked better flavor-wise with Ango, but my Mole bitters are in a dropper bottle, and my Ango is just in the dasher, so I wanted the precision that the dropper gave me. So
yeah totally get it.
I do not have a back half beer. I've just got water.
Cool. Sounds good. For me, what I am having on this fine evening, meant to be pretty simple and straightforward, like PJ mentioned on the top, I've got an airplane that I have to catch eventually, not immediately tonight, but in the morning, in the wee hours. So I am just having a Tropical Frightening. It's spin on Tropical Lightning that Wilmington Brewing does. It's their like blood orange equivalent, and it is so good. They do it every season around Halloween, and then again in February. This year, and maybe it was last year was the first year that they did this, but they also added raspberry into it, and so raspberry and blood orange, and it is so good.
Nice.
It's an Imperial IPA. Super tasty. Love it a lot.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. So we'll begin the second half here with That's Entertainment. The King!
Someone squeals.
for no reason that made any immediate sense, as someone is out there trying to find a drugged Jizal. Of course, there are lots of Knights of the Body that are kind of around and taking care, and we kind of come to realize that over the course of not only this scene, but the next, that there's a lot going on there. But this whole chapter, which is like 7 or 8 pages, is just pure chaos. I mean, beginning to end, It's so well written. It's so crazy. There's bodies falling, people vomiting, there's swords drawn, Friendly flinging people out of fucking windows. There's a blast of orange flame as Casca witnesses it, as Renoko, our guy that we saw spitting fire before, loses control and lights this damn place covered in ivy on fucking fire.
Crossland. Mm-hmm. Do you know what that description tells me?
What does it tell you?
This is a ballroom blitz, Crossland.
This is a ballroom blitz. This is a ballroom blitz. Oh man.
Yeah,
very much so, actually. Yeah. It's a ballroom blitz. That's a great call. It's so crazy, and I like didn't put it's so hard to like break down the scene because it is literally one line of this thing, one line of this thing, one line of this thing. What'd you think?
I mean, it's just so much. There's just so much happening. And it's so visceral and visual.
Mm-hmm.
But to your point, it's so hard to break down in any sort of like meaningful individual way. It's just cacophony, like visual cacophony.
Good. That's a great description of it. And like, it's also, of course, excellent that this chapter is titled That's Entertainment, as the entertainment goes feral. I didn't mention this earlier when we were talking about it, but the moment in which the fighting starts and the band kind of like gets the cues from the moments when otherwise they've been playing very shittily and have been commented on to be pretty bad, but they start playing in moments with the swings and highlight, and that's such a cool idea. And then in addition here, seeing them all like pull out the weapons basically and start chopping is a fun turn.
Tons of fun.
Daggers flying, you know, everywhere, indiscriminately, not sure if friend or foe, you know, one of the guys is flinging them.
Doesn't matter at this point.
No, that's sort of Casca's conclusion. And Casca and Shivers manage a sort of controlled retreat in the moment before it's declared that it's every man for himself, because it's hit that level of wall, as Casca calls it. There are flashes again of a lot of different people shouting in the chaos and violence. I love of it all, as you described it, including Friendly raging still about those dudes mocking the dice and kind of throwing like what we assume are just bodies around. Like this is so ripe for adaptation, because we'll visually understand where Friendly is and we will see people be flying everywhere. And we don't need to see Friendly to know why that's happening. Yeah. So Shivers makes the call, though, to go run and find Monza, headbutts a guard, knees him in the fruits before flinging him down the stairs as well. You know, in this moment, that man of the body.
Yeah. Do you think Friendly really understood that all the things happening around him were completely disconnected from the dice incident, or do you think he assumed that, or do you think it was just like kind of a blind rage?
I think Friendly has, to me, Friendly has Drax energy, if that makes sense, from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay.
Have you know, yeah. I just think that he like is you've seen Guardians of the Galaxy. That's not like crazy. Yeah. Okay. At least the first one. Maybe I think you saw the second one. I don't know.
Definitely. I did.
Anyway. Yeah. So yeah, Drax, just like, not like the go over my head thing, but just kind of getting like lost in the sauce of the moment. And so then when everything else explodes, I think he's just like, this is what it is. It could have been my fault, but I don't think he's even considering that. I don't think he's considering or contemplating it. I think it's just, it's go time.
Mm-hmm.
The guards can't control the prison outbreak, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
he's been there before.
But it is nice to see Shivers take up the mantle of rescue party in this moment.
Yeah.
Someone's got it.
A burning building. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny to me as well that he like takes out this Knight of the Body who is probably just trying to find Jizzal and rescue the king. And he specifically doesn't kill the man, but he does, I mean, embarrass him, to say the least. Like, he headbutts him, he clips him with his shield, he knees him. Like, that's a bad time.
Yeah, that's a little... That's one that you don't... That's a story you don't bring home from war.
Yeah, you know, no one ever gets to learn that story, for sure.
Happens at Cardani, stays at Cardani.
Yeah, what happens in Sapani? This is Sapani. It stays in Sapani. He does finally find her, though, and there's this great moment as he kind of realizes the only path out, as the smoke has gotten so high in the room, as obviously the building is burning down and getting worse. He smashes open the window that would allow, or the other window, you know, effectively one's over the courtyard, one's over a canal, and flings her out of the window into the canal. And then he himself kind of begins to freak out because water is his enemy. His namesake is literally because he like cannot swim that well. And he got cold from one time of being in water for too long. So he fucking jumps in, flails in the water before Monza helps calm him a little bit, allowing him to tread decently enough in the moment. While they both watch the pleasure house burn as Shivers begins to cry and she kind of calms him, but neither really has any idea what's like transpired.
Right. I think this reveals to me what the true theme of the series is, Crossland.
Yeah.
And that is,
I feel like we haven't hit a theme of the series.
Northmen falling from high places into water.
Just like always. I mean, fairly accurate. There's a lot of jumping from windows in high places.
Cliffs and windows.
Yeah. Yeah. Water sometimes. You know, Logan almost fell in that first book and died if it weren't for Pharaoh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
And they're on scaffolding.
We can call the flood of
the theme
practicals water for this instance.
For the sake. Yeah, it was a body of people.
A body of bodies.
A body of bodies. They were alive. It's a nice scene. It's also a good way to wind down tension. And again, this book screams adaptation, and this moment in particular, this set of chapters is just perfect. This like paper to page is perfect.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. And from there, we hard cut, as we would if this were a screenplay, into what happened, our final chapter of the week. We then return to our soldier of fortune or misfortune, Nakomo Casca, waiting outside the warehouse from a distance, where they would assuredly return to meet at. He really hasn't seen anyone come and go yet, but Vitari gets the upper hand on him and surprises him from behind, and they catch up on the results of the fiery bloodbath, which is, I think the best word to describe it was a bloodbath. This is definitely a bloodbath. And that's what he says, which is such like a good note. And it seems mm-hmm. to their minds that all of the mercenaries are likely to have died as well.
It's, given everyone. It's the most realistic outcome. And as a certain Northman might have said, you've got to be realistic about these things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, we didn't talk about the specifics, but like even Shivers was trying to fight against a Knight of the Body and accidentally cut a random woman in half that like got in the way while she was like running, you know, like
straight
this
up
is full chaos.
Just hacked her to pieces.
Yeah. Well, just one strike. It just went, Oh God. But yeah. With all the increased security, I feel like it's really unlikely that like anyone really made it out of there, you know, like comparatively.
Probably not.
Yeah.
All our people did.
Yeah. But they're skilled. They're talented.
Right.
Well, and more Veer and Day left early. So like they were fine.
they did their job.
Shit happened. Yeah, they did their job and left, which is exactly what was requested of them. Yeah, cool moment. We then turn to Friendly, of whom is sitting in the darkness in this room, covered in blood, rolling his dice. He gets 3 and 4.
3 and 4.
It an ordinary 3 and 4. 3 and 4. And calls it an ordinary score. Casca then like picks up the dice and rolls and just asks to pick up the dice politely, you know, consent, and then rolls and gets a 6. And he's like, so you beat me, you know, because I always lose. And I got to say, like this sort of budding friendship between these two as Casca wipes and cleans the blood from his neck, you know, is so cool. It's so neat.
I mean, it's great to have the 3 and 4 come up with that being the current score, as it were, for Monza. Mm-hmm. It's just a nice little touch. And as far as this friendship goes...
It's also a convenient thing with dice, because 7 is the most frequent roll, right? So it's just a different breakdown of 7, which is why we're conveniently getting it, because it would be the most common occurrence.
Exactly. But as far as this friendship goes, every loudmouth needs a quiet counterpart, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a perfect it's a perfect pairing. It's great.
Mm-hmm. There's something almost like, it feels weird to say like friendly when you're also talking about friendly, the character, but there's something like vaguely, I don't want to say fatherly, but maybe it is. The way that Kosuke approaches this feels not that dissimilar from like how we saw him approach Monza when we saw that like flash back from his past, you know?
Yeah, he sees something in friendly that he's latching onto in some way, whatever that might be. I like the fatherly kind of read on it, but it's not necessarily
like he feels the need to nurture, you know? Yeah. Like it might not be father, but like nurturing.
Yeah.
Like he cares.
Something genuinely. Like that.
Yeah. Morvir also returns with Day, and there's a lovely exchange between him and Kosuke about indiscriminate slaughter and slaughter that fails to discriminate, which is the definition of slaughter, right? And that's kind of what Kosuke is bringing up. Very interesting as sort of we compare even the events of, you know, part two versus the events of part three. And the results aren't that different. A lot of people died that didn't need to, but it wasn't at the fault strictly of, you know, them.
Yeah, I think that's
yeah. We'll call it.
Is it their fault?
Read.
Is completely like, yeah. That's a fuzzy line to draw.
Yeah, right.
That is right. That is a very. Like,
if they weren't there, it would have never happened. Yeah. But also,
that's drawing a line on a paper with a paint roller.
That is the funniest analogy, PJ, you've ever made. And I don't want to like crown it so highly necessarily, but that was great. Good shit.
I mean, it makes sense to me. I don't know.
No, it's perfect. It's literally perfect. It's I didn't mean that disingenuously. It is. That is, I think, your best simile, analogy, metaphor, whatever you want to call it, that you've ever made.
Mm. Well, thank you.
So good.
Yeah. I tried very hard.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, like an 11. An 11 by 5 or whatever. And it's just all rolled in paint. Oh, man. In the moment, though, in this moment of victory, Morvir gives him a flask of alcohol, kind of chucks it at him and says, like, good job. And he gives him that drink, and he pours it out. Now, I think there's probably some, like, subsequent debate about, you know, like, what we think in the flask. We can talk about that if you know, whatever. I think that's fun. But there's also some debate that happens between between Kosuke and Morvir about what to do if Monza's died and should we like just tally and divide the coins immediately, you know. And Kosuke throws a dagger pretty well out to hush the naysayer that is Morvir.
Yeah. He says something along the lines of, what if you had missed? And he says, I did.
Yeah. I like that line. Like, it's also like a genuine question again, because there's all, a Jack Burton element to Kosuke.
Exactly. I mean, Kosuke really does seem to have a fairly rigid moral code.
Yeah.
And with like adheres to it with very little wiggle room.
It's a gray moral code, but it is.
Yeah, it's
is
hard to nail down exactly what that code is, but he's consistent about it, at least as far as I can determine. As far as that sort of debate on what was in the flask, I believe it truly was just liquor.
I think it was too. And I think his suspicion isn't unfounded, but.
Yeah, but I don't think. Even if he was 100% sure that it was liquor, I think he still would have reacted exactly the same way because of that code that he, like, the job's not done. He's sober for the job and he's going to stay sober for the job.
More of a choice too, in which I think that he's kind of coming out of it on this other side of like, you know, I feel I can find other ways to feel alive to some degree.
Well, there's still the niggling thing in his mind of like, I'm going to keep note of where that flask threw or where I threw that flask in case there's a couple drops here and there left in it. Like,
but that's also the addict's mindset.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. That's just impossible to shake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You like don't ever, as I've heard it described many times, you like don't ever get out of that mindset, right? Like with something incredibly and truly addictive. Often the one that I've heard is out of drugs that I've heard are generally the most damaging is heroin. We had a close friend growing up of whom was a recovering heroin addict and had been sober for like 7 or 8 years when I knew him. He's I'll tell you further details a little bit later, but he had said that, you know, an important delineation is that like you are constantly an addict and he was constantly fiending, but at the same time, like trying to live as much of a normal life as possible. And it gets easier to ignore, but it doesn't make it not present. And that was sort of the reality, which I think is sort of the same thing that we're experiencing here with Koska.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see him turn it down one way or another. Also, mm-hmm. if Morvir poisoned him, I think everyone else would kill him, you know, in that moment. I don't think that anyone likes Morvir enough to not just fucking cut him down if he killed Koska like that.
Right.
Yeah. Like,
that's
bad
true
gambit.
Too.
Yeah, totally. Dagger scene's great, though. I love the dagger. I love the poison. I love the flask. I love their interaction and their bickering as the old men of the group. So in that moment in the warehouse, this dark warehouse, two figures bust in as Shivers and Monza make their way into with the rest of them. Koska immediately sells out Morvir. Basically just explains. Morvir explains his theory of caution first out loud, of which we've heard repeated many times. It's his own sort of internal monologue that not internal, but
it's an external
mantra.
Monologue in the form of day.
Yeah. Right. Correct. It's his mantra. I internal monologue. I meant mantra. And then day is sort of like the call and response is with day, which is so good. She ultimately says that she's happy they got Oreo and that they should leave Sapani right away. You know, like mission accomplished effectively.
Yeah. I think of all the situations, this is one that Monza would completely understand and gets the sentiment of it. But it was so funny for her to just be so dismissive and just be like, yeah, 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 we got a boogie. Mm-hmm. She's like, no, nah, we got to get the fuck out of here.
On top of that, I think one other detail here is that she's probably still a little bit high. I mean, not exactly sure how long that opium high lasts. But then on top of that, it again shows Koska's moral code, like we were just talking about. Like Koska feels loyalty to Monza and so then immediately tells and owns up to the truth immediately. Yep. You know, the reality
or
of the situation.
Maybe he thinks this is a quick way to get rid of Morvir.
True.
Like,
it could also be that.
He's been pretty vocal internally and externally about how much he fucking hates that guy and poisoners in general.
Mm-hmm. Definitely true. As that becomes the conclusion, she kind of goes upstairs to change real quick. And there's this sort of interaction that happens between Vittori and Koska. And Vittori says, "That is one stone-hearted bitch," Vittori muttered as she watched her go. And then Koska replies, "I always said she had the devil in her. But of the two, her brother was the truly ruthless one." And Vittori says, "Huh. It was a compliment."
But this, what this opens up for me mostly is more of an interest in Benna and more to look forward to in these sort of interstitial flashbacks at the beginning of each part. I assume Vittori stays with the group. Like, she just joined in Sapani. Like, she could reasonably stay in Sapani as they leave, but they've made some pretty big waves, so I assume she's mm-hmm. kind of like, well, I'm in for it at this point. But I don't know. I could see it going
either
way. I
also think that there's an element of being locked in at the very end of this chapter that I think forces her hand to some degree. We already talked about it a little bit, but like the letter includes Vittori's name on it.
Oh, it does include Vittori's name, doesn't it?
Yeah. So it's either I stay with the group or I immediately go into hiding, you know, as a response.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seek shelter with the cripple.
Yeah, exactly. That'll go well. So I hadn't brought this up before, in part because, you know, part of me always loves to like leave nuggets, of course, for like you to find at time to time, or like for you to draw upon. And I by no means am I dismissing this to any stretch, but I wanted to bring it up this time so we can focus on them as we go forward here. So for the third time as it's happened, we get a quote from the beginning section of the compliments that Benna layered on real thick when they were on their horses going up to Orso's place, as as Monza reflects on that moment and her own drowned corpse reflection in the mirror. She reflects, "You're a dream, a vision, the very goddess of war," before she puts on one of Benna's shirts to like warm and comfort her. And it's the closest that she could ever get to a hug ever again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I kind of chalked it up to her, like that being the primary last memory of Benna.
Oh, yeah. I'm not suggesting that it's not. I just mean that we've gotten one every section.
Yeah, we do.
Either shortly before or shortly after we've gotten a target, right? And so it's this internal fuel that she's still feeling very deeply and reflecting on those final moments with her brother.
Which, I mean, she should if she's
right.
So set on continuing this quest, because it is the entire point. Like this, there is the fact that they betrayed her too, but the primary focus of her vengeance is Benna. Like he is the reason behind all of this. So it's reasonable that he's fairly present in her mind. I do love this goddess of war thing, because in any other context, it's hard to take that as a compliment, but it works perfectly for her. It works perfectly right, in this context, too.
That's who and what she is, right? I wanted to reflect a little bit on something that you said regarding Benna, and it's like, this is all for Benna, and as we've gone through these flashbacks, it's like, this has all kind of been for Benna, like, from the beginning, you know? Like, their choice to, like, go into mercenarydom and, like, to do everything else was one made of survival and ease, you know? This was the easy path. Because she was responsible and had to take care of her brother. Like, that was the whole thing. So.
This is how she could do it.
Yeah. This is how she do it. The way in which you said that just triggered that in my brain, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop it.
All good.
Yeah. So from there, we then come, after she changes into clothes and gets out of sort of her wet attire, we then come to the arrival of Carlot, Dan, Ida, and how she explains how it went out of control when Fosker had a headache and sent the king and his Union entourage instead of attending himself. Aryo is explained to be deader than fuck as well by Monza, which is, again, I think she's high, which is the only reason that she's saying that. But it's also italicized in the text, deader. Like, it's so good.
Yeah. It's a good epitaph for the dude. Is he?
He's also the shithead. He's the count.
Yeah, he's the count. Fuck him.
Yeah. Yeah, fuck counts.
Fuck counts. But things can never just go the way that they're planned for Monza, can they?
Mm-hmm.
Why do things like this always happen to me?
Yeah.
To quote Shivers.
Or to kind of quote Glockta. Glockta has a lot of that same internal monologue.
Pretty true.
Is it always me? Yeah. Especially in the blade itself. But yeah, man. We kind of get the why of it all, and we get all this sort of picture painted. But Carlot, of course, is also very panicky, as she is told that there never was any poison, as she's demanding this cure that was likely going to kill her, which is a prediction that you made but didn't write it down. But I will take it. You explicitly said, because I pushed you to kind of like, what do you think it is? So I'm going to take a drink, because you did get it. But,
okay.
Yeah. So good work.
Thank you.
And all. But yeah. And now that she's going to have to do her best to outrun the cripple before she is set free, she explains that she also wrote a letter to Orso telling of Batari, Casca, and a little Mercado bird as well. He knows the game now, and the stakes of our story have entirely changed.
It can't be that hard to outrun a cripple, right?
I don't think it's about outrunning Glockta himself. I think it's about outrunning Yoru.
I know.
The eater.
Yeah, that's fair. Monza, in this moment, in her husk-addled mind, she does such a good job of reading the situation and recognizing that by doing this, Carla has inadvertently kind of hitched her wagon to their caravan. Like, for her to recognize that and kind of twist the knife with it a little bit, great move on Monza's part.
Yeah, yeah. Not only is she like hitched the wagon to their caravan, but she can't take a side now. She's got no information and is of no use to everyone is her enemy, which is why freeing her ultimately doesn't really matter. And also, Monza, we were talking about like flexible moral codes, but it's like, you're not a part of the people that I need to kill. So go away now.
Yep. But I think the biggest point was you better hope we kill Orso because you're kind of fucked if we don't.
Otherwise you're dead. In addition, I mean, Carla Danida survives like a fucking cockroach.
She's hard to kill.
All this.
She's
nearly impossibly hard to kill. Any other thoughts on like what this letter could mean for the future or any other sort of things as we leave Supani?
I mean, it creates a much narrower timeline. Like it requires things accelerate much more rapidly, much more aggressively. But
heists are going to be harder. You know, they knew who the targets are. They're going to insulate themselves more. It's very much like the progression forever ago in the like early Assassin's Creed games, where like the first couple were really easy. But once they realized somebody was killing the people that were connected to them, it gets harder. And like there are a lot more guards and there are a lot more people and feels similar in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. A natural progression. Okay. So I want to end this part, since we kind of did this in two parts, just on sort of any sort of other general thoughts or reflections that you had, or like, how'd you feel on the whole about part three, Supani? What were your concluding thoughts?
Concluding thoughts. We've seen Monza, like, I thought we'd start to see her slip a little bit at some point and start questioning why she's continuing this path. But she's really resolved herself to continue it, which is making for an amazing story, but was kind of surprising to me after the, like, especially after that first part with the torture. I thought we'd see her starting to crack a little bit. Maybe we still will, but she's really steeled herself and has focused her ire. Yeah. She's ready to go.
Yeah, she still isn't compromised much.
Right. Much, almost at all.
Although she, going from, to some degree, going from Westport to Supani, she's more okay with the slaughter now at this point. So it's like, it's kind of a question of like means justifying the ends. And it seems like her goalposts are moving actively.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. She was pretty horrified by the killing of all of the bankers, and now she's didn't bat an eye at the
fiery bloodbath.
Yeah, the fiery bloodbath. Because that is the perfect way to describe it. Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Shivers too. He's starting to kind of he hasn't stopped really questioning. But he's just as complacent as he was going into the section, I think.
Yeah. His morals haven't changed or shifted, but they have remained, and he's questioned them more, I think, especially with Koska throughout the 2 weeks. Like he's talked to Koska kind of as like reflecting against an older person of whom has been through a ton. And yeah, that deeper irony in the bad, bad man, where it's not actually that he's a bad, bad man, but you know, maybe it is. Maybe he is a bad guy.
Could be.
Yeah. Has the potential to be, like we all do.
Some fucking dice.
Yeah, do not apologize to my fucking dice. Yeah, Friendly. I assume Friendly is still like your highlight.
Oh, God, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, I want to make sure, make it clear to everyone listening at home, I don't think that Drax is anywhere near like a character. Like, they're not approximating. I would not approximate the characters outside of the way that they locked into combat in like the same sort of scene and style, yeah. Like rage, you know, like a barbarian. But by that, I mean like a D&D barbarian. Yeah, cool. Any other thoughts going in?
I don't think so.
All right, cool. Well, we already paid off a number of the bets as they kind of came up over the course of the week. I don't think that there were any others that we had missed. You know, the other one that you had made last week was about Mother being the first poisoning victim. So no information or answers there. But with that, next week, we're going to be reading, starting part 4, Viserine. And it's Viserine through the chapter The Darkness. And this is another two-parter, as far as these go. The most that we ever do until the very end of the book is two parts. So okay. We're pretty much taking these, kind of splitting them. But the final one is three, for the sake of story and ending and stuff like that. So very excited for this next week's reading. And yeah, can't wait for you to experience this. Yay. This section. Yeah, cool.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am too.
All right. You got a smug look on your face, and I don't know what to think of it.
Yeah, I have so many thoughts.
All right.
and you're just going to have to read before we can talk about it. So
that's fine.
that's where we're at. Cool.
All right. I guess I could end the episode, huh? If you would like to follow us on social media, you can do so by typing into your computer box or your phone orb thing at Words Whiskey Pod on pretty much whatever. And we'll be there and we'll be hanging out and we'll be chilling stuff. But if you look deeper into that phone orb, you can press a couple buttons in the right order and you can leave us a vocal message at 910-408-2534. You can also text that number, but that's less
in
mysterious.
Your phone orb. Yeah.
No, your regular phone for that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beyond that was the funniest way that you've ever said either of those things. Super good. But also, you can leave us a review. We highly recommend it. We would love it if you did. And if you don't leave us a 5-star review, which is very important, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening to and on whatever platform, we are going to ask you to fucking apologize.
Very aggressively.
Extremely
aggressively.
After we've killed you. Yeah. Which, again, I didn't necessarily strictly mention it in that order, but he kills them first and then asks them to apologize, which is like,
I think he does it first and then he kills them and then he continues to ask. Like,
he kills one or two of them and then asks and screams and then kills the third. Yeah, but yeah, so fucking good. Flips over the table. Oh man. But beyond that, I'm very, very excited to continue in this series. It is a bright spot in my otherwise dim weeks. So, you know, appreciate all of you listening out there. And also for making this series our most successful series to date. This is, I mean, like, naturally, it's crazy. I didn't think we'd ever hit our Red Rising numbers, because where you start is generally the footprint that you leave for the most part, or like what people know you for. And I'm glad that so many people have accompanied us through our journey, not only of the first law, but then really joined and like hooked onto the wagon for Best Strip Cold. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Happy to have you.
Thank you all so much. Yeah. In case you couldn't tell. And thank you to everyone of whom wrote in to make me double check the Vitari facts. It was 5 people, I think, collectively in the same
week.
Is
it her kids that has curly hair or something?
One of them did this week, but we didn't see the kids beforehand.
We did. Severard did.
Oh, Severard. Yeah, may have described. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of them. That could be it with curly hair. But yeah. Must have been it. Okay, cool. All right, with that, we'll see you next week.
All right, bye.